Matter of State versus Tawana. May we please have appearances of counsel?
Good morning, Your Honor. Assistant Prosecutor Patrick Eldier for the state.
Good morning, Your Honor. Deputy Attorney General Stephen K. Cuttanaro on behalf of the Attorney General Amicus Curiae.
Good morning, Your Honor. Emily Graham on behalf of the respondent, Amandeep Tawana.
Good morning, counsel, and welcome. Mr. Galdieri, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I would ask to reserve a minute or two for rebuttal if necessary.
That's fine.
Both the trial court and the appellate division in this case incorrectly ruled that the statement defendant made from her hospital bed to Detective Espelot was the product of the functional equivalent of interrogation. Because defendant's statement did not result from interrogation or its functional equivalent, it was admissible regardless of the absence of Miranda warnings. First, as the published appellate division cases that are discussed in the state's brief at length make clear and support the conclusion that Detective Espelot's words and actions did not amount to interrogation under the United States Supreme Court's decision in Innis, the standard that was enunciated in Innis has been adopted by this court, and it's that interrogation includes not only direct questioning, but also any words or actions on the part of the police that the police should know are reasonably likely to elicit an incriminating response. Here, those words and actions by the detective are straightforward and clear based on the record, and they consisted entirely of, I would just note that the reason that what I'm about to say, these actions and words by the detective, why they are what is entirely relevant here is because of the finding by the trial court and the appellate division that the defendant was subjected to custodial interrogation the moment the detective entered her hospital room. So those words and actions leading up to the moment that he entered her room were walking up to a defendant in her hospital bed, standing next to two other officers at the foot of her bed. The state disputes the factual finding that those officers were already there upon the detective's arrival. However, it really, the state agrees actually that it doesn't, with the appellate division, that it doesn't matter to the interrogation analysis. There is no interrogation either way, whether those two officers were already there or if they accompanied the detective. The detective introduced himself to her as a prosecutor's office detective and told her they were investigating the incident that occurred that night. Now, that language, that they were investigating the incident that occurred that night, is exactly what the detective testified to at the testimonial hearing. And that's important because he didn't say he was investigating her. He was investigating the incident. She was involved in it. And then before he had any chance to really elaborate on that or explain what, you know, give meaning to that, give Miranda warnings, what have you, anything, that's when the defendant immediately, is what the detective credibly testified to, immediately blurted out that she was experiencing pain in her chest and arms, as well as that she had two shots prior to the crash. Therefore, that statement that she had two shots prior to the crash was spontaneously, unexpectedly, and unforeseeably volunteered by defendant, and it was not elicited in any way by the detective. There's no reasonable person in the detective's shoes that should expect a person to incriminate themselves upon introducing yourselves and saying what your role is in the prosecutor's office as a detective and that you're there to talk about what happened that night. Just one last thing before I conclude my opening statement, the federal and out-of-state cases discussed in the state's brief provide ample additional compelling persuasive support for the state's conclusion here and for the proposition that the appellate division and the trial court incorrectly decided this case. Having said all that, the state would rely on its brief to the extent that I didn't address anything that's argued in there, and I'd be happy to answer any questions your honors might have.
Questions, anyone? Anything you'd like to add to your presentation?
No, that's all. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Cuttanaro.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Defendant's spontaneous and non-responsive statement was admissible for three separate but related reasons. First, the detective's presence in defendant's hospital bay was not the functional equivalent of interrogation. Contrary to the appellate division's conclusion that the presence of these officers was likely to elicit an incriminating response, an incriminating statement is an inherently unforeseeable response to an officer's mere presence. Second, and similarly, a detective's introduction is not the functional equivalent of interrogation either. No one would expect a defendant to respond to a simple greeting with an incriminating blurt out. Third, and finally, every court in this country to consider these issues agrees with those common sense propositions. Every court to consider these issues has concluded that neither police presence nor an introduction is enough to elicit an incriminating statement. The Attorney General is aware of no contrary cases, and defendant has cited to none. A contrary conclusion is both unworkable and unwise. If warnings are required by an officer's mere presence or an introduction, then they are functionally necessary in every single encounter, whether that encounter is investigatory, interrogatory, or a mere encounter on the street.
Counsel, this wasn't a mere introduction to the street. This wasn't a passing hello. Wasn't there a specific purpose for his presence there?
Your Honor, the officer's testimony is very clear on this point. He was told to go down to the hospital to, and I'm just going to quote from the transcript, for the purpose of introducing myself as a detective with the Hudson County Prosecutor's Office and advising her that we are investigating the incident that occurred. In essence, he was told to go down to the hospital and to introduce himself. That was his purpose for being there.
Well, he was directed by the sergeant specifically to go to the Jersey City Medical Center to make contact with the officers injured and the driver of the incident, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so not just introduce himself, but to make contact with them.
To make contact is part and parcel with an introduction. The first thing you're going to rationally do when you see somebody you haven't met is to introduce yourself.
And what would the next step be then?
Per his testimony, the next step would have most likely been to leave. There, it's clear from the surrounding facts and from his testimony that he wasn't there to take a statement. And indeed, when defendant began to make an incriminating statement, he stopped her forcefully and told her, I'd like to interview you, but that needs to be at a later date when the interview is recorded. No statement was taken, and he didn't intend to, by his own testimony. That's not why he was there. And if warnings are required by his presence and introduction there, then they are functionally necessary in every single case. That construction would render the fifth interrogation requirement a dead letter, in essence. This is not hyperbole, as defendant suggests. It's the reasonably likely result of that construction. And if your honors have any questions, the Attorney General is happy to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Cotton.
Thank you, Your Honor.
It's grand. Please go ahead.
Your Honors, and may it please the court. Every day, police officers have contact with hundreds, if not thousands, of people across the state. And when officers are in contact with people who are not in custody, whether they're on the street or in an interview room, officers are free to question those people extensively. And on the other hand, when an officer has contact with someone who is in custody, but when they're engaged in the core duties of their job, the functions that they're entrusted by the law to do, arresting suspects, booking suspects, transporting them, executing search warrants, the law recognizes that that will involve some inherent interpersonal contact. And officers are permitted to speak to those people, including by asking them questions. And nothing in the decision of the trial court would have an impact on how any of those officers go about their day-to-day duties. But what an officer is not permitted to do is to approach a suspect who is in custody, make no attempt to Mirandize her, and to engage her with words or actions that were reasonably likely to lead to an incriminating response. And that's exactly what the detective did here. April 2020 was a time when no person wanted to find themselves in the middle of a global pandemic in a hospital room in Jersey City. But that's where Detective Espelot went when he strode right up to Ms. Tijuana's bedside, stood over her at 3 o'clock in the morning, and began to speak to her. He did not do that as a courtesy. And that was the finding of the trial court,
and it was affirmed by the appellate division. And in the face of the very limited testimony that the state chose to elicit, the one witness the state chose to call, faced with the testimony of an officer who did not actually tell the trial court, nor did the state elicit the specific words he used when he spoke to her, and an officer who could provide no justification for his presence there other than to make contact with Ms. Tijuana in an interaction that was not recorded, the trial court found that while the detective may have been credible, he was not reasonable in that circumstance. And the decision of the trial court was limited to the specific factual scenario before it, to both the perspective of the defendant and the perspective of the officer. Were this court to affirm that decision, there would be little impact on officers who are engaging with suspects who are not in custody or who are transporting or booking suspects. But a reversal in this case would be a green light for officers to approach someone in custody at any time and proffer no justification for it and hope that, like Ms. Tijuana reasonably did here, the suspect would incriminate themselves. That concludes my preliminary statement. I'd like to turn to the issues I raised in my brief in the order that I raised them, starting.
Could I ask you to start by telling us specifically what did the officer do that was wrong? What did the officer specifically do that violated this defendant's rights?
The officer did a few things. He went up to someone who, given the circumstances that she was in, she had just been in a very serious car accident. She had a very serious, very high blood alcohol level. She was constrained to a hospital bed and a floor that was a largely law enforcement controlled environment. And he approached her for no reason. And I think the fact that there's no reason is important there. Had he been there because he needed to obtain her cell phone, or to take photographs of her, there would have been a purpose for having a person in that vulnerable place have an encounter with a police officer, but it was entirely unnecessary.
So give us the principled rule that you're advancing that might belong in an opinion to give guidance to law enforcement on what to do and what not to do.
So I think and I will answer that question not to avoid the question. I think what is somewhat difficult is that the Innis standard is inherently extremely factually specific. The trial court did consider the totality of the circumstances here. So I'm not advocating for a rule where anytime someone is in a hospital bed, an officer should not approach them. And I'm also not saying that anytime there are three officers present, they need to begin with the Miranda warnings.
But what are you saying?
What I am saying is that in this case, when an officer has no justification to approach a suspect who's in custody and just does so because he wants to do it and enforce.
Why is the officer justification relevant if we're talking about an objective, if we're talking about the objective defendant, not an objective officer? Someone in a hospital bed has absolutely no idea what the officer's subjective intention is. So why does it matter what the officer had been approaching, intending to do?
So I think it matters for two reasons. The first is that I actually think it looks different from the defendant's perspective when the officer is approaching with a specific purpose and a reasonable law enforcement purpose.
Here, how would she have known that, just in terms of, didn't the officer only get out, "I'm a detective from the Hudson County Prosecutor's Office"?
So the testimony that the officer stated was that he introduced himself and that he advised her that the investigation was ongoing. So we don't actually have the specific words. We don't know whether he said to her, "Hi, how you doing? I'm Detective Espelot." We don't know whether he said, "I'm a detective from the prosecutor's office."
But even if he would have just said, "I'm a detective from the prosecutor's office," that's a pretty preliminary statement of introduction upon approaching her. And as Justice Wiener Apter stated, how would she have known what purpose in that very limited interaction? From what we understand from the testimony, it was a very limited interaction. There wasn't much time for the officer to say much of anything before defendant made the statements with regard to how many shots she had and made the statements with regard to the pain in her chest. So again, how would somebody in her situation have any understanding of what the officer's purpose was when there was not, doesn't appear to have been enough time for that information to have even come out?
So to respond to that question first, Your Honor. The testimony was that he was present at her bedside for approximately 5 minutes, and that he introduced himself and that he advised her of what was going on.
It was less than 5 minutes.
I think he said 5 minutes or less, which the trial court did find to be credible. So I do believe there's a reasonable conclusion that there were some periods of silence where he was present there in terms of how long introduction took place, the specific words that were used.
So take with what you've just told us from the record. Walked over to her at bedside, introduced himself, and assumed there was some moments of silence. How does that amount to the functional equivalent of interrogation?
So in this case, I think it's important the specific facts and the totality of the circumstances of Ms. Tijuana. I am not suggesting that any time an officer walks up to a person, even any time a person's in a hospital bed and introduces themselves, that's the functional equivalent of interrogation. And the trial court did not find that either. The trial court said that under these circumstances, it was.
Isn't that exactly what you're saying? She's in the hospital because she was in a bad accident. She's hurt. Presumably somebody's in the hospital for a reason. They're sick, they're hurt, they're there for a reason. Isn't that exactly what you're saying? Anytime they're there and the police officer comes up to them, that's the functional equivalent of interrogation.
That's not my position.
Seems to be.
The appellate division didn't even rely on any words said. The appellate division said that the defendant was subject to the functional equivalent of custodial interrogation the moment the detective entered the hospital room. So that's walking in, presumably before he identifies himself as a detective. His very presence required a Miranda warning. I mean, if you read that and, you know, taking that language in its plain meaning, an officer under these circumstances in a hospital has to walk in saying you have the right to remain silent before even introducing himself to the person. So can you cite us any case in which the entry of a detective into a hospital room has been found to be the functional equivalent of an interrogation?
Both in this state and in other states, there have not been cases that have held that, published decisions that I'm aware of.
How about in this circumstance, where they don't just walk in, they say something, introduce themselves, they don't ask questions, but do sort of what did, is there any case like this anywhere in the country?
Not that I've seen, Your Honor. And I think in part that is because this is it's a highly factual standard that requires considering the totality of the circumstances here.
It's nothing terribly unique. I mean, sometimes you see fact patterns where it's not surprising to find no case on it because it's a series of bizarre sequence of events that just simply is unlikely to be replicated elsewhere. But this is an injured individual who's been in an accident, whose BAC is high, in a hospital, and a detective walks in. I mean, it's quite a typical scenario of what happens after a serious accident. So doesn't that tell you something when there are no cases anywhere recognizing this functional equivalent of interrogation that the trial court and the appellate division did?
What I would say, Your Honor, is that I think the trial court considered the testimony of the one officer who was in front of it and actually considered some additional things that needed to be considered. For example, the circumstance that Ms. Tijuana was in. I think he also considered the benefits to the state.
Sorry, this is what you said.
The circumstances of Ms. Tijuana, the position that she was in. She was a non-citizen. She had never been arrested before. She was in custody in the hospital. And I think that is important because there are will certainly be circumstances when officers are having contact with individuals in the hospital who are not in custody. And the trial court's decision does not implicate any of those conversations with a person who is free to leave, who has not been constrained.
What about when they are in custody? Victim of a shooting or something like that. What about when they are in custody? There are many of those cases floating around.
And there are many of those cases in Hudson County, too. And I think in that situation, I think the footnote 7 of the Innis decision is important. The trial court, I think, to return to Justice Quainer-Apter's earlier question, it's not a subjective standard. It's the standard from the defendant's perspective. But the Supreme Court did leave an opening with footnote 7 to say that to the extent the court is able to ascertain the motivations of the officer, that may be relevant as to what the officer reasonably should have expected to happen.
You mentioned earlier that the officer was acting unreasonably and there was no justification, but the officer was investigating how a motor vehicle accident occurred. Isn't that an expected duty of an officer to find out?
And the officer did not testify that that's why he was there. The state could have elicited that he was there because he wanted to see what her blood alcohol level was, or he wanted to obtain physical evidence from her, or he wanted to bring her down to the station. If that's truly what happened, if the officer really did have a legitimate purpose for being there, the state could have made the decision to elicit that information before the trial court.
Is it an illegitimate purpose to introduce yourself to someone and say, I'm going to be conducting an investigation?
And I think not in every circumstance, but in this circumstance where Ms. Tijuana's physical condition is an element of the offense that the state would be prosecuting, asking, hey, how are you, to someone who's charged with a burglary may be an innocuous question.
That's not what happened in this case. It wasn't, hey, how are you?
Well, we don't know, actually, specifically the words that he used. What the detective testified to was that he introduced himself.
And the trial court found the detective's testimony credible. So if we're going to... I think your argument is that we should there should be deference to the trial court findings with regard to when the three officers walked in and all the other trial court findings. So if we're giving deference to the trial court findings, the trial court found the detective credible. So the detective said he introduced himself. Correct.
Yes, Your Honor. And I don't dispute that his testimony was found credible, only to say that he did not actually testify. I said, my name is Anthony Espala. He testified that he introduced himself.
Is there a difference?
I think there is in this case.
A material difference for purposes of the Innis analysis, whether he uses his name or introduces himself?
I think so, Your Honor. And the reason for that is that for a person in Ms. Tijuana's perspective who's in the hospital bed, an officer might walk in and say, hi, I'm Anthony Espala. I work at the prosecutor's office. He might also say, hey, how you doing? I'm Detective Espala. Like, how are you feeling today? And I think a human being would categorize both of those things as an introduction. In common parlance, people typically say, hey, how are you? Almost off the cuff when they're introducing themselves.
Is it in dispute that he said he was investigating the incident? Words to that effect, maybe not the precise quote.
He said that he went to advise her as to the investigation. So we don't know the specific words, but it's not in dispute that he said that he advised her in some capacity.
From a practical perspective, on this record, when should he have advised her of her rights?
In this perspective, these facts, I believe it would have been when he walked into the
immediately.
Room. Yes.
So before he says his name, before he says that he's from the Hudson County Prosecutor's Office, before he says that he's investigating a motor vehicle accident, he just walks right into the room and says, you have the right to remain silent, goes right into the Miranda warnings.
I think
that's what's required constitutionally.
I think it would have been appropriate in this case for him to say, I'm a detective with the prosecutor's office, I'm investigating the accident. Before you say anything, I'm going to read you some warnings, which is frankly quite typically how a detective might begin an interrogation.
What if the person blurts something out? Before getting to the, I want to first read you your rights.
So it would depend on the totality of the circumstances. And here, given that the officer had no reason to go to her bedside other than to engage her in a conversation, I think it was reasonable for him to expect that she would respond.
Take a more traditional situation. Suppose your client had not been injured and instead had been brought directly to a police station, placed in a room, and then three officers walk in at once, including a detective who says, I'm introducing myself, I want to question you. And then there's a blurt out.
So
is that a violation? Is that an Innis violation?
Not necessarily, because I think that
isn't
situation...
Isn't that worse than the situation that took place here?
So I think that situation is different in a couple of key respects. The first is presumably that interaction would have been recorded if it was happening in an interrogation room. I think the defendant would have some notice that there was some ongoing criminal proceeding, given the fact that she was transported to an interrogation room. Ms. Tijuana was in a hospital room where a person both has a lack of privacy. They're presumed to be extremely forthright with the people that are speaking to them. She had, in this case, been questioned extensively by medical personnel about very sensitive information, somewhat more primed to be talkative. And I also think this returns to an earlier question the court had about, would it have been different if he had approached her with a different intention? And the reason I think that looks different to Ms. Tijuana's perspective is that the law presumes people will comply with police officers. We require them to do that. If an officer stops you unlawfully, you don't get to run away. You have to wait there and you litigate the constitutionality of the stop later in court. We presume that people will comply and they need to comply. And when an officer says, I'm here to transport you, I'm here to take photographs of you, I'm here to take your phone, there's a way to comply with what they're asking you to do that doesn't require you to speak. It's very easy. I'll hold up my hands to be photographed. I will hand you my cell phone. But if there's an understanding of both human nature and how humans realistically respond when someone introduces themselves to you and someone asks how you're doing, and especially in the face of three officers standing over your bedside, that it was reasonable in this circumstance for the detective to believe Ms. Tijuana would say something responsive.
You're adding the how are you doing, right? He did testify that he introduced himself, but he did not testify that he said, how are you doing? How are you feeling tonight?
That's correct, Your Honor. I would argue that her response, I'm experiencing chest pain, I only had two shots of alcohol, seems more responsive to someone who was asked, how are you doing? But it is not in the record that that's specifically what he said.
It's not in the record. The trial court made specific findings as to what the officer said based on his testimony and found them credible. You're literally making things up and inserting them into the record, aren't you?
I would disagree with that characterization specifically because the officer testified he introduced himself and he advised her. He did not say those are the words I used. I would say that those are sort of summaries of what he said. He did not testify, I advised her of X. The state did not say, what words did you use? And given—
He had simply said, if he had characterized as an introduction a question to her about her physical condition, that would not have been an accurate statement. Introduction would not include questioning of her as to her physical condition in its normal meaning, would it?
I think that if he had said something like, how you doing today, that could be considered an introduction versus how are you feeling, what are your symptoms, that would seem to go beyond.
What is it you're saying that he said that we should assume for purposes of this case that he said?
I think it would be reasonable to conclude that if Ms. Tijuana responded, I'm experiencing chest pain, I only had two shots, that the detective's introduction sounded like a common introduction many people use. Good morning, how are you? I'm Detective Espelot. I'm here from the Pensacola County Prosecutor's Office. I think even if he did not say that, still his actions in approaching her, given the circumstance she was in, given the fact that virtually anything she said might be useful to the state at trial, would be likely to be incriminating under the Innis standard. So I think even if the court disagrees with me that may be what he said, it would still have been interrogation. And I think it's important here that the detective was an experienced detective with the prosecutor's office, with the unit that investigates motor vehicle accidents.
Which is probably why he immediately told her to stop talking.
And I would say that the fact that he told her to stop talking, I would find that that does not go to both what his intentions were in approaching her and his conduct, because at that point he had gotten the information that he wanted. He had gotten information that would be used in the prosecution of the case that was sufficient to continue the investigation to obtain search.
So you're saying that we should surmise from the fact that he told her to stop talking that he had arrived in the room looking for an incriminating, un-Mirandized statement, and he told her to stop talking because he was done with that purpose. Is that what we should assume?
I believe at that point he had obtained information that was useful to him. We can't know specifically why he told her to stop. It could also have been because at that point he realized, oh, the defendant is willing to talk. We should do this on camera in a way that can be played at trial. Perhaps he thought, my supervisor is supposed to be the person who gets this information. Maybe he had now established a rapport, which is certainly an investigative technique.
I don't know any of that. You are literally adding to the record. No, nobody, I mean, we're limited under Innis to certain things, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, and you agree that that's the standard, Innis?
Yes.
And you're suggesting somehow, I guess it was footnote 7?
Yes, Your Honor.
More white. What about footnote 7 opens up these considerations that you are suggesting, other than what you've extrapolated from the record? I mean, all it says that is deliberately elicited information. And you seem to be extrapolating from the record to get to that point that's in footnote 7?
So I would say that the trial court's conclusion was that it found that the detective did go to the hospital for the purpose of obtaining a statement. It rejected the state's argument that the detective had gone for another reason and made a factual finding as to why the detective went there. And the Innis court in footnote 7 did say that to the extent the court can surmise the purpose of the officer, that may well be relevant to what the officer expected to happen when he walked into the room.
So let's say we agreed with you that the detective went to the hospital specifically to get a statement. You're saying that he has to give Miranda warnings before he introduces himself and before he says he's investigating the incident that occurred that night. But then don't we end up with challenges saying that the waiver of the Miranda warnings was not knowing and voluntary because the officers did not disclose what they were investigating?
So I don't believe that that's necessarily what would have happened in this case. Certainly, he might have advised her of the Miranda warnings. He would have had the opportunity to give her a Miranda form, to have her have the time to review it. He could have, if she had already been charged, pursuant to this court's decisions in AGD, advised her of what those charges were. And presumably, because she was in custody, he would have hopefully attempted to record that interaction as well.
So he's got to do all that walking in before saying, I'm so-and-so. He's got to walk in, as I read the opinion, he's got to walk in Mirandizing as he walks in. And of course, as you mentioned, AGD, he's got to explain the purpose of an arrest and comply with AGD. All of this is before he has any interaction with her. He's got to just be a walking recording of the Miranda warnings as he comes in.
And it might sound like that's a lot of effort to put onto an officer. But I would say that the Innis court actually does say that an officer needs to do that. The standard is not...
Innis court says he's got to walk in and Mirandize as he walks in before an introduction.
It does not explicitly say that, certainly, Your Honor.
It doesn't even remotely say that.
What it does say is that an officer, whether an officer should know, his actions are reasonably likely to elicit an incriminating response. That puts an onus on law enforcement to act carefully.
But no other court has ever found that an officer's mere presence or introduction is reasonably likely to elicit an incriminating response, correct?
That's correct.
In fact, they found the exact opposite.
Well, I would say that the out-of-state cases that were cited by the state, I have not found a specific case that specifically addressed this scenario. The case that addressed an officer's introduction in one, the person had already been Mirandized. They were sitting at their hospital bed listening to them speak to a doctor. So it was not specifically the factual scenario that was in front of the trial court here. I would say that under these circumstances, the officer did have an obligation on his drive to the hospital to consider why he was going there to interact with Ms. Tijuana, to act reasonably. And
even if he was going there to elicit incriminating information, couldn't he introduce himself, say why he was there, and then give her the Miranda warnings? How do we know that his next sentence would not have been the Miranda warnings had she not blurted this out just in response to his saying his name and saying why he was there?
So in this case, the detective did not testify that he was there to question her. He testified that...
I understand, but the appellate division seems like... the appellate division says the trial court correctly found that the only reasonable explanation of their presence was to obtain information about a criminal investigation. So assuming the trial court and the appellate division are correct, why would that still be wrong in how he went about it? He introduces himself, he says why he's there, then he gives Miranda warnings after that.
And if that had been one singular conversation, if he had said, Good morning, my name is Detective So-and-so. I work at the prosecutor's office. I'm going to read you your Miranda warnings. That may have been a different situation, but he did not do that in this case.
But even if that had happened, wouldn't you still be raising the argument that given her condition, given the circumstances, that it wasn't a voluntary waiver if she blurted out a moment after he had given her, said, I'm about to give you your Miranda warnings?
Separately, that might have been raised, the voluntariness given her condition. Was not something that the trial court considered here as to whether to exclude the statement. And it goes to perhaps why it might be inadvisable to try and obtain a statement from someone who has just been involved in a serious accident. But I'm not asking for a rule where an officer can never go to a hospital bed, where an officer can never try to speak to someone who's injured. That's not what the defense is asking for, and that's not what the trial court ruled. The trial court limited its ruling to the specific factual scenario before it. Where the trial court noted it had only heard from one officer, did not hear from the other officers who were present. Given Ms. Tijuana's condition, her experience with the criminal justice system, blood alcohol level, and given why the faculty officer could not give the court any explanation for why he went and approached her at 3 o'clock in the morning, given those circumstances, where she was in an emergency room, where there were at least 6 other officers mere feet from her, an additional 2 at her bedside, under those conditions, it would be reasonable to expect that she would say something the state would seek to use.
One more question about the record. We have the officer's testimony, and you've more than once mentioned that the state didn't follow up and ask for the specific words that were used. Did the defendant?
No, Your Honor. In this case, it was the state's burden to establish that the statement was admissible, and I believe that the trial court properly held the state to its burden here.
It was the state's burden, and the testimony was that the officer introduced himself. What is the dictionary definition of it to introduce? Plain meaning of the word?
I don't know off the top of my head, Your Honor, but I would say that an officer, it would be reasonable for the court to conclude that part of an introduction might be the common parlance, how many people think. If I had walked in and said, my name is Emily, good morning, everyone, how are you? I don't know that anyone would have disputed that I introduced myself any differently than if I had just merely said my name. I think in light of how Ms. Tijuana responded.
And if you did that in this room, would it be reasonable to expect that people would start disclosing their medical condition or what they had been doing over the past few hours? I would respectfully suggest no.
And I completely agree, Your Honor, and I think that's why it is actually important. Certainly, custody is not the issue before the court, but the nature of Ms. Tijuana's location is important. Given that she had been in a hospital bed for 2 hours, that is part of the record, she had been questioned extensively by medical personnel about her sensitive medical information, the light of the environment she was in, I think, does presuppose a different response. And I'm not saying that if the detective had gone up to her at the police station, at her home, at the scene of the accident, that necessarily that would have been interrogation. But merely under these circumstances.
You're saying this is a stronger case for interrogation than if she were at the police station?
I think given the fact that the incriminating information was medical, was about her physical condition, the fact that she was at was in the hospital is certainly a relevant factor.
The incriminating information, yes, she said she talked about her pain, but the incriminating information was not her comment about her pain, as I understand this record. The incriminating information was her disclosure about 2 shots, right? So that's not how she feels. That's about what happened over the hours preceding the accident.
And I think in light of the detective coming in after she'd been questioned by medical personnel, who did testify, they asked her about alcohol use. That's something they would have asked to determine appropriate course of treatment. Those questions concerning alcohol use had been raised to her by medical personnel in the context of her discussing her condition and how she was.
Ms. Graham, I think we have your position. Are there additional questions anyway?
I just have one last question. So is it your position, just to clarify, that the reason you're couching the introduction, the plain meaning of introduction, with how are you or how are you doing, is it specifically because of her response and the physical condition she responded with?
I think it would be more reasonable for her to have responded that way to being asked, how are you, than if he had just said his name. I think it appears to me to be a fair reading of the record. However, even if he had just said his name, walking up to a person who had just been asked for 2 hours by medical personnel about all of their conditions, about what they had consumed, about how they were feeling, it would be reasonable that she would respond in that way.
Anything you'd like to add?
Only, Your Honor, that the circumstances of this case are that Ms. Tijuana is alleged to have consumed alcohol to have then caused an accident that at the time the officer went to her bedside had left, in the words of the officer, a fellow officer fighting for his life. It was a serious accident where her condition was going to be extremely relevant to the state at trial. Under those circumstances, the trial court had the opportunity to hear from the detective who was there, to hear the limited testimony the state chose to elicit, and found that under those circumstances, it was reasonably likely that what she would say would be useful to the state at trial. And the defense is not asking for a bright line rule or to say that in every hospital situation or every time there's three officers, there's an interrogation. But here, the trial court held the state to its burden, and I would ask this court to affirm it to ensure that law enforcement continue to exercise care before they go to approach someone who's in custody.
Yes.
Just one question. Why is her condition, physical condition, in any way relevant to anything the police were doing? Her condition.
So her condition at the time of the accident would be relevant as to whether she could be convicted of the subsection of aggravated assault by automobile that required her to have been intoxicated.
No, I get that. What about her physical condition in the hospital is in any way relevant to what the police are doing? We have her blood alcohol. It's almost three times the legal limit.
Yes, they had not obtained that at the time that he spoke to her.
We have that. She's injured in an accident in the hospital. What about her physical condition at the hospital? Where she hurts? What is relevant to anything the state might do in this case?
So I would have two answers to that. The first would be the state did move as part of the same hearing to admit the statements Ms. Tijuana made to her treating nurse and treating doctor.
I'm not asking that. I'm asking, if you can't answer, you can say that, but what about her physical condition?
So
is relevant to anything, not what she told anybody else, not, you know, what her blood alcohol was, not whether she was intoxicated during the accident. What about her physical condition is in any way relevant to anything the state is doing in this case?
And so I apologize if this sounds like a non-answer. I do mean for it to be responsive.
I know you do.
The state moved to admit the statements Ms. Tijuana made about her medical conditions, her physical condition, because the state argued, since she didn't tell the doctor she was experiencing any other medical condition, that's relevant that she doesn't have a defense, say she had a stroke or a seizure, and that's what caused the accident. They used her failure to mention another medical condition to the doctor, and the state moved to admit those statements, and the trial court did admit them. And so I would argue that to the extent in that moment, she is not having a stroke, she's not having a seizure, her physical condition is that she appears to be otherwise fine. That would be relevant given the way that the state has elected to prosecute this case. And I would also say her intoxication level is part of her physical condition.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Galdieri,
I don't really have anything to add. I'd be happy to answer any questions your honors might have based on what's been said.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Come to the center, please. Were there any body cams available to the detectives in the Hudson County Prosecutor's Office?
I specifically asked the assistant prosecutors trying this case that, and I've been told that at the time that this happened, that our office did not have body cams, but that the Jersey City Police Department did.
And what purpose could there possibly be for the officer to go to the at that point, potential suspect's bedside, other than to ask questions about why this accident occurred, given the high speed and the nature of it?
His specific testimony, the detective, which again was found credible, was that he went there, the quote was, for the purpose of introducing himself and advising her that the prosecutor's office was investigating the incident that had occurred. And then when he testified as to what he actually said to her, that's what he said his purpose was. He said almost exactly the same thing as what he said his purpose was in going there. And then when she interjected and blurted out that immediately said that she had that was experiencing the pain and had the two shots, that's when then he told her, "Whoa, I didn't come here to get a statement from you. I wanted to take a statement from you in the future on video at the prosecutor's office," which would make sense that he would go there and tell her that at the hospital at that time, even though it was in the early hours of the morning, because she was in an unidentified location right after it happened. He didn't have to go track her down days after when things might not have been as fresh in her memory. So Not only did he not have to give a reason as to why he was going to the hospital, because that's what Miranda protects against, but his reason was perfectly objectively reasonable. It made a lot of sense. And it's in the record.
He also was introduced himself to the officers who were injured as well.
Yeah, he spoke to them first. And while we're on this subject, just really quickly, because I know this is rebuttal, the finding by the trial court judge that the detective was accompanied by two officers when he entered the room in the I think PA 3 or 4, it's at my desk, in the fact findings and procedural history of the trial court opinion, the trial court says that the detective was accompanied by Detective Monahan and Valenti, who are the two of the three that were injured in the crash. So that's why there is not sufficient credible evidence. Not only are all the quotes from the detective about the two that were stationed at her bedside and how he went there alone and he didn't have a partner, all almost directly say that he entered alone the room. The trial court's finding was that he was accompanied by the two detectives that were injured in the crash. So that's not supportive of that finding at all.
It's the state's position that the record supports the inference that he walked in alone.
Yes. And this, again, Your Honor, and as the state mentioned initially, it doesn't really matter. Ultimately, there's no interrogation here at all. But just for the sake of being factually accurate.
Well, just to be clear, though, were there two officers stationed outside of her curtain?
There were two officers at within a foot or two of the detective when he introduced himself and said he was the detective of the prosecutor's office and there to investigate the incident. The two officers were already in the room with her and were standing within a foot or two of him when he said that at the foot of her bed.
You keep saying room, but if my reading of the transcript is that this is an emergency room, open area with curtains dividing up each section. So we're talking about a sort of free form.
Yes, location. In her direct vicinity at her bed.
So potentially visible to her through the curtain or by the feet standing at the corners of her curtained area.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Potentially visible to her, the officer's feet at the bottom of the curtained area or through the curtain, the officer's position there.
Potentially, but the record doesn't say that she saw them. The argument about eight officers being present is a reference to the officers that were with the other two that were injured there. There is testimony that they were there with them, but there's no testimony about their impact on the actual interaction that occurred directly at the defendant's bedside.
So to the extent there was an entry, and that's it would be in quotes because we are talking about the room with the curtain, not a separate room, but a room with curtains, to the extent that that enclosure, I'm not sure what the medical term is, but that enclosure was entered, the state's position is that only the detective entered.
The record's clear in that, yes. The state's position is that the record clearly shows that he entered alone.
Sorry, and I thought you had been saying that the record was clear that he entered alone, but the other two detectives were already inside. But then it sounded like in response to Justice Noriega's question, you were saying he entered alone and the other two detectives were outside.
Oh, no. I meant to say, if I said they were outside, I meant to say they were inside.
Okay.
There were two others already in the room,
curtain already.
Right around her bed.
Okay.
And there were the others with the other officers as we go expand out farther away from her bed. But there were two with her already.
Okay.
The detective walked in alone. They were all standing within about a foot or two of each other at the foot of her bed. That's what the record, that's the state's understanding of what the record says.
So walked in together, didn't walk in together. There's three officers
about
a foot from her bed at all times.
And that's why the state says that it doesn't really matter whether he went in together or they were already there, because at the critical time when he said what he said and was there, there were three officers there total, right there.
Okay.
With that, I would rely on the state's brief.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Take the matter under advisement. Thank you.